Do you obsess over cold cases?
Do you go down endless rabbit holes on online forums, searching for clues to solve your pet case?
Are you an armchair sleuth? If so, we'd like to invite you to check out our new podcast, Citizen Detective.
I'm Mike Morford.
I'm Nama Cates.
And I'm Dr. Lee Meller. We work hand-in-hand with citizen detectives just like you to examine some of the most puzzling unsolved mysteries out there.
Citizen Detective is out right now, and new episodes drop every other Saturday.
Subscribe now so you don't miss a single episode of Citizen Detective.
The evidence will show you that these crimes were premeditated. Premeditation simply means thinking about it in advance. He thought about it in advance.
River Falls is a college town in Wisconsin of around 15,000 residents. It's located around 25 minutes southeast of St. Paul, making it the perfect commuter town for those who want to escape the hustle and bustle of city life. In summer of 2012, police and paramedics in the town were asked to conduct a welfare check at the home of a family. As they entered, the distinct smell of gas emanated in the air, but there was no sign of anybody. That was until they proceeded up the stairs and entered a bedroom that was splattered with blood. One family who called River Falls home was the Schaffhausen family, consisting of Jessica and Aaron Schaffhausen and their three little girls, 11-year-old Amara, 8-year-old Sophie, and 5-year-old Cecilia. Jessica and Aaron were married on the 27th of May 2000, and in October, Amara was born, followed by Sophie in 2003 and Cecilia in 2006. When the girls were born, Jessica felt like her life was complete. She had always wanted to be a mother, and as her friends said, she was always the one they would go to for parenting advice. Stephanie Horst stated, "She was just real and honest." The pregnancies for Jessica hadn't been easy. She was really sick throughout all of them, but as Stephanie said, she was happy to do it because she knew what prize would be at the end. Amara and Sophie were both students at Greenwood Elementary School, where Principal Nate Sherman described them as bright girls who always came into school each morning with a smile on their faces. Cecilia had really been looking forward to starting kindergarten. Those who knew the family said that the girls were always exceptionally sweet and kind. Amara was something of a tomboy. She loved skateboarding and playing soccer. She was the inquisitive one of the trio, always dreaming up experiments that she made notes of in her notebook. On one occasion, she rigged up a string system that allowed her to turn on her bedroom light from her bed so that she could read. She also loved baking, especially pies. Sophie took part in martial arts and Girl Scouts. She was also a keen and talented artist, with her artwork being shown in several school exhibits. She too was a bit of a tomboy and loved climbing trees in the neighbourhood with her sisters. Cecilia, the youngest one of the girls, was affectionately known as Sia. Despite her young age, she had a massive personality and an intense curiosity. Her family said that she was never afraid to let you know what was wrong and right, and she loved making art with nature. Cecilia also loved seeking out insects to inspect, and she absolutely adored babies. Soon enough, however, cracks in the marriage began to emerge. Aaron had dropped out of school, but he lied to Jessica, claiming that he was still going. This resulted in Jessica having to pay the school a large fee. He worked from time to time, but Jessica was the main breadwinner in the family. She got up and went to work each morning, while Aaron played World of Warcraft most of the day, refusing to do any chores or even help with the girls. Most days he would drink to the point of intoxication and he was emotionally absent to both Jessica and the girls. In a bid to try and save the marriage, Aaron went to a therapist for feelings of depression and anxiety, and he was given a prescription for antidepressants, which improved things for a while, but not to a degree that could save the marriage. In August of 2011, Jessica asked for a divorce. The couple separated, and Aaron moved out of the family home. In January of 2012, the divorce between Jessica and Aaron was finalised, and Jessica and Aaron were granted joint custody of the girls. Jessica had primary physical custody over the girls, and she also had control over healthcare, education, and other decisions. Aaron would have the girls most of the summer breaks and on various holidays throughout the year. He was also ordered to pay child support of $1,353 per month, and he assumed the couple's debt of $196,000, which included the mortgage of their home. Aaron was earning $4,666 per month as a carpenter. It was decided that the girls would live with their mother Jessica at their home in the 2700 block of Morningside Avenue. The neighbourhood was a newer subdivision located on the eastern edge of the town, just near the River Falls golf course. It was a really nice area for a family to live, and especially for children to grow up in. The neighbourhood was well maintained and the homes had nice spacious gardens for children to grow. There was a neighbourhood park as well, which was perfect for the girls. The home actually belonged to Aaron, but Jessica was renting it from him. Aaron moved into his own apartment in Minot, North Dakota. He confided in his friends that he was upset about the divorce and had been taking antidepressants. He became obsessed, calling Jessica constantly at work and at home. He was angry about the divorce and he even became cold with the girls, refusing to speak to them on the phone. However, he became furious when he learned that Jessica began dating a new man, Josh Flanders. He responded by calling up Jessica and screaming expletives, and even calling up Josh and making threats. Aaron even called Josh's mother, Judith, and told her, "If you don't want to see your son's life shortened, he needs to stop fucking my wife." He told a friend that he fantasized about killing Josh and putting his head on a stake in the front lawn and drinking a beer. Aaron told Jamie Schneider, a friend who he knew through their children's daycare, that Jessica had a sugar daddy and was worried that the girls were going to be taken to Illinois. Jessica was happy to finally be away from Aaron, but the abuse continued. In March of 2012, Jessica called police in River Falls to report that Aaron was harassing her and threatening her. Aaron had called her up and told her that he wanted to come to River Falls, tie her up, and then make her choose which one of the girls he was going to kill, and then force her to watch because he wanted her to hurt as much as he hurt. Understandably, the call terrified Jessica, so she contacted police and went to the police station to fill out a statement. Before she arrived, however, Aaron had called police himself and told them that he'd been having dark thoughts. In a follow-up phone call to Aaron, River Falls police officer Elizabeth Posel told him that he needed to leave Jessica alone, to stop calling her and to stop threatening her. Aaron was argumentative with the officer and was somewhat incoherent. He said, "Here's the deal. Until I can conjure dragons into this world, it's not a big deal." River Falls police contacted Minot police and they checked up on Aaron, but they determined that he was not a threat. As per the police report, units spoke with Aaron Schaffhausen. He states he has no intention to go back to Wisconsin. Everything is fine at this time. This wasn't the first time that Aaron had made these kinds of threats, and he even made them in the company of other people. One night in March, he had called up his cousin, Liz DeLeeden, and told her that he was thinking about killing Amara, Sophie, and Cecilia. He said he believed that the antidepressants were making him have these thoughts, so he stopped taking them. He said that he had been thinking about slitting their throats, and revealed that on one occasion he had even driven halfway to River Falls to do this, before turning around. Liz told Aaron that he needed to get some help and that he needed to stop drinking. That same month, Aaron spoke with his friend, Jamie Schneider, over the telephone, who he knew from their children's daycare. Jimmy worked as a professor at the University of Wisconsin River Falls, and at one point had actually instructed Aaron in a chemistry course in 2009. She had also recruited him to do some research work at the university because he was a methodical planner who paid meticulous attention to detail. Anyway, when they chatted on the phone, Aaron said to Jimmy that he wanted her to help Amara with science and expressed anger that Jessica wasn't teaching Amara science, just to make him mad. The conversation was certainly illogical, and Jimmy tried to calm Aaron down, telling him that he was being silly. Aaron flew into a rage, yelling at Jimmy, before hanging up. In April, Aaron called up Jessica and told her he wanted to come to the house to watch the girls sleep. By the time summer rolled around, the threats from Aaron had finally ceased. He had stopped taking his antidepressants and had stopped drinking. He told Jessica that he was feeling much better. Over the summer holidays, the girl went to spend some time with their grandparents in Illinois before coming back to River Falls in July. The 10th of July 2012 started out like any regular day for Jessica and the girls. Jessica got up and got ready for work. It was summer, so the girls were off school. Their babysitter, Fallon Moore, arrived, and then Jessica went to her job at Metropolitan Area Agency on Aging, which is a non-profit organization that helps elderly people live independently and helps people return to their homes after being in a nursing home. That afternoon, Jessica received a text from Aaron. He said that he was in St. Paul and asked if he could visit the girls. Jessica's first thought was, shouldn't Aaron be in work? He had worked at a construction job in Minot, where he lived. However, Jessica was unaware that just 5 days earlier, Aaron had actually been fired from his job when he failed to show up for work. It was an unplanned visit, but Jessica thought why not, and she let him know that the girls were at home with the babysitter. Jessica told Aaron that she wanted him gone from the home by mid-afternoon, which was when she was scheduled to come home from work. She didn't want to see him, and she thought it were best if he left before she got there. While Jessica and Aaron still weren't getting along, the threats had stopped, and Aaron appeared to be getting better. He had recently told her that he was moving on in his life, and had even been on dating websites. Their relationship had improved somewhat, and they had even been chatting about normal things, such as books, music, and movies. Jessica really wanted the girl's dad to be in their lives. They really loved their father, and she didn't want them to miss out on having a father figure in their lives. Moreover, they hadn't seen their father in 2 months. Aaron showed up at the home, and the girls were ecstatic to see their father. They rushed up to the front door, grabbed Aaron's hands, and took him upstairs to show them some of their toys. The babysitter, Fallon, followed close behind. She texted Jessica, letting her know that Aaron had arrived home and asked her whether she needed to stay or whether she could go home. Jessica replied, telling Fallon that she could leave. She hugged the girls goodbye and left, leaving Amara, Sophie, and Cecilia at home alone with their father, Aaron. Around 2 hours later, Jessica received a phone call from Aaron. He chillingly stated, "You can come home now, because I killed the kids." Jessica rushed from the office to her parked car and took off in the direction of her home. En route, she placed a phone call to 911. The journey from Jessica's office to the home was around 40 minutes, and as she drove, she stayed on the lines of the 911 operator, Eileen Splitgerber. She was hysterical, hyperventilating, and the distress in her voice was more than audible. "I'm hoping he said this just to torture me," she said, before adding, "Oh my God, I'm so stupid." It was hard to decipher what she was saying, so Eileen asked her to slow down. Jessica explained the situation, and police were immediately dispatched to the home, arriving there before Jessica. Police arrived at the family's home at around 3:30 p.m. As soon as they opened the front door, the distinct smell of gas wafted up their nostrils. They called out to Aaron and to the girls, but they received no response. The officers proceeded through the home, stepping over toys and walking past the marked heights of the girls on the kitchen wall. In the living room, they found that the gas fireplace was turned on. When the gas fireplace was turned off, it was determined that there was a second smell coming from the basement. In the basement, they found gasoline poured on the floor. It had come from a gasoline container, which had been tipped over. The officers continued the sweep of the home, gradually making their way up the stairs. It was on the second floor of the home that they made a grim discovery. All three girls were found dead in their respective beds. Their eyes were wide open, in a fixed stare at nothingness. They were all tucked in, with their blankets pulled up to their necks. All three had dried blood on their ashen faces, and in Cecilia's bedroom there was blood all over the carpet and some splattered on the wall. It was evident that the three girls had been killed in this one bedroom. When the blankets were slowly taken off the girls, it was evident that they were dead. They all had deep gashes to their neck. Their throats had been slashed. There was also evidence indicating that 5-year-old Cecilia had also been strangled and had sustained a superficial defensive wound to her forearm. Aaron was nowhere to be seen. Around an hour later, Aaron showed up at the River Falls police station. He was wearing a pair of shorts which had been stained with blood. Police officers tried to question Aaron about what had happened with the girls, but he refused to speak. He was arrested on suspicion of homicide and booked into the jail. After the arrest, police would go door to door in the neighbourhood, informing concerned neighbours of the tragedy and letting them know that there was no risk to the public. While Aaron had first of all remained tight-lipped, when he was brought into the interrogation room, he began to speak, but not after remaining silent for around 2 hours.
Aaron, you came here for a reason. You presented yourself to the officer, and you told him, let's go. I wasn't out there when you did that. But if you did that, there was a reason. And I'm just trying to find out why. And your daughters are deceased. They're gone. And I'm sorry. What was happening inside of you when this happened here? Why are those babies dead? Let me tell you why I know you love them. Because you put them in the bed together and you covered them up. You put them in the bed together and you covered them up there. Because you wanted them to have peace. You wanted them to have peace. You wanted them to have peace. They're together now.
He is being interrogated by River Falls police investigator Charles Golden, and he had said something to the effect of, only a father would cover his children up in bed, cover them in blankets so that they could be at peace. This comment made Aaron break down and tell the officer that he needed help. Investigator Golden asked Aaron if he had killed the girls, to which he replied, I don't know, I saw them. He then added, I want my girls back.
Tell me what happened. I can be these girls' voice. If you want me to be, I can be their voice. But I can only be their voice if I know the truth, man. Okay? I asked you if I should be looking for anybody else, and you shook your head no. Right? That's because there is nobody else, man. You knew that. You knew that. Tell me what you do know. Tell me what you do know, Aaron.
My three girls are dead.
How did it happen? Did you see them? So, okay. Tell me what you saw, Aaron.
The murders really stunned the community, with Police Chief Roger Leake stating that it was the worst case he had ever seen in his more than 34 years with the police department. Law enforcement and emergency responders are trained, to a degree, to viewing shocking scenes while adhering to their duties. They do have to deal with serious events every single day, but as Police Chief Leek said, not to this level, not this horrific. He praised his officers and the paramedics for their professional attention to the case, and said that it would take them all some time to recover from what they had seen inside the family's home. Principal Schumann at Greenwood Elementary School said that they were all going to be pulling together to try and get through the tragedy, adding that staff were going to be available to speak with students and parents about the case and talk them through their grief. The city followed suit, announcing that they too would be offering support services for anybody who needed it. They would hold a group session and private sessions at River Falls City Hall. In addition to support, the school would establish a memorial wall, with Principal Schumann announcing, "A memorial is beginning to form in the front courtyard at Greenwood, and students are welcome to contribute to that. There is also a signing wall being developed outside the main office." Many of the girls' friends added to the memorial, with Amara's friend, Alison Pizzi, writing, "I will miss you very much." She described her friend as kind and fun to play games with. Alison's younger sister, Olivia, had known both Amara and Sophie, and she wrote, "I am sorry," on the wall. Alison and Olivia's mother had brought their girls to the memorial wall, hoping that it would bring them some kind of closure. Another one of Amara's friends, Blake Paltrow, was afraid to sleep and had become increasingly clingy, his mother said. Blake had lived in the same neighbourhood as the girls, and while he played mostly with Amara because of their shared love for skateboarding and soccer, Sophie was always hanging around too. In fact, Sophie had a little crush on Blake, writing him a letter while staying at her grandparents' home, telling him that she missed him. Is there anything better than a classic whodunit? If you're into true crime and mysteries, then you're gonna love June's Journey. In this online game, you'll play as June Parker, a detective investigating a series of mysteries. June's Journey is set in the 1920s, giving it a real vintage and glamorous feel. In each chapter, you find yourself involved in a murder mystery, and you meet interesting characters along the way that give you some helpful tips and leads to crack the case. With new chapters each week, you'll never get bored of June's Journey, and you'll always have a mystery to try and solve. June's Journey is really therapeutic, and I find myself playing it before bed late at night. It really tests your observations and helps to keep your mind fresh and sharpen your sleuthing skills. There's a detective in all of us. Find your inner detective. Download June's Journey free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. The memorial wall would grow with each hour that passed. Parents, teachers, students, and even people who had no connection to the family would show up to leave trinkets, flowers, and teddy bears in the girls' memory. In the aftermath, a fund was established at First National Bank of River Falls under the name Benefit Account for the Schaffhausen Children. The purpose was to help Jessica financially, with funeral costs and general expenses. She had just lost her three girls in the most horrific way possible, and their own father now stood accused of killing them. She was going to need all of the support that she could get. The community came to the bank in droves. Children came with their pocket money, the elderly came with their pensions, and the rest came with whatever they could spare. By the end of the day, the bank had collected more than $30,000. Jeff Johnson, who's president of First National Bank of River Falls, said, "We live in a very close-knit, tight community. People look out for each other here. People here rally behind one another when things go wrong. Everybody looks out for one another." The community would come together to try and make sense of the tragedy at a memorial vigil just the day after the gruesome discovery in the family's home. Around 300 people gathered at Glen Park, including many of the girls' friends. Amara's soccer team all wrote the number 36 on their cheeks in her honour. 36 was the number of the shirt that Amara wore when she played soccer. A lot of them also wrote messages of condolences and grief on a soccer ball. The day after the memorial vigil, Aaron was charged with 3 counts of first-degree intentional homicide. He was ordered to be held on $2 million bail and was ordered to have no contact with Jennifer or her immediate family. A private visitation and service was held for the girls at Kilcarney Hills Golf Course. The media were not allowed to attend, but Flint Watt, who was Jessica's uncle, would provide a quick statement, telling the media that the focus was on the girls and the family. The service included lots of photographs of the girls, as well as some of their favourite music. "Speaking of Jessica," he said, "she has struggled. We all have. She is talking to some people, trying to get help. And of course her family is gathered around her and doing their best to protect her. Along with the shock and heartache that was expressed within the community, there was also fear among some residents. Fear that the same thing could happen to them." A lot of phone calls came in from victims of domestic violence to Turning Point, which is a resource centre for victims. A lot of the callers reported that they too had been threatened by their partners or ex-partners, and now they feared that if Aaron could escalate to such violence, then how likely was it that their partner or ex-partner could do so as well? According to the Wisconsin Coalition Against Domestic Violence, between 2000 and 2010, there was an estimated 402 domestic violence homicides in Wisconsin. Out of these homicides, 53 were children. In fact, out of every 33 homicides in the United States, one is the killing of a child under the age of 18 by their parent. This translates to around 250 to 300 of the murders each year. Filicide is the deliberate act of a parent killing their own child. And in the aftermath of such murders, many people erroneously assume that the parent who committed the act must be legally insane, because they understandably cannot comprehend how a parent could do that to their own child. Typically, in cases of filicide, however, the parent isn't motivated by insanity or even a desire for violence, but instead, a desire for power and control. Aaron hadn't only killed the girls, but he had called up Jessica to let her know what he had done. It was a final act of trying to control Jessica and exert the most pain on her as physically possible. Revenge against a spouse is the most common motivation in filicide. A preliminary hearing was held towards the end of the month, where it was decided that there was enough evidence against Aaron for him to stand trial on the 3 murders. During the hearing, his defense attorney, John Kaczynski, tried to raise doubts on whether River Falls police had been operating out of their jurisdiction. The judge said that they were not, and that they were well within their jurisdiction. Aaron would additionally be charged with attempted arson of a building. Following the preliminary hearing, defense Kaczynski spoke with the media and revealed the defense he was planning for his client. He stated that Aaron was delusional and depressed, adding that he had been depressed for quite some time and had been taking medication. He said that there were people who had been concerned about his abnormal behaviour before the murders, including Jessica, who had told family that he had some serious problems. Towards the end of August, Aaron would be back in court, where it was expected he would enter his plea on the murder charges. However, defence Kaczynski stated before the judge, "We're going to stand mute." Judge Howard Cameron Jr. then entered a plea of not guilty on Aaron's behalf. The following month, defense Kaczynski asked the court to stop a mental health professional from visiting Aaron in jail. He said that the mental health professional who had been visiting Aaron in jail was an agent of the state and that the visits were violating Aaron's constitutional rights. He accused the prosecution and staff members of the jail of working together to try and collect information about Aaron that they could then use against him during the trial. The sheriff had directed staff at the jail to document Aaron's behaviour, as well as make notes of his visits and interactions. Defence Kaczynski said he feared that when Aaron was speaking with the mental health professional, that the information would not remain confidential. When Aaron came to jail, he was considered a suicide risk, and it is routine for mental health professionals to work with inmates at jail. It's part of the sheriff's duty to provide mental health care to the inmates. If Aaron didn't want to speak to the mental health professional, then he didn't need to. Defense Kaczynski argued that Aaron was no longer a suicide risk, and had invoked his right to remain silent without an attorney present. Certain technicalities were being ironed out. What would have been Amara's 12th birthday passed on the 5th of October. The girl's family would come together to mark the poignant event and release balloons. Her aunt, Mary Liz Stotz, said that they hoped the event and balloon release would raise awareness to domestic violence. At the event, family friend Julie Milers said a few words. Amara was a humanitarian and a lover of life. If this had been a classmate of hers instead of her, she would have wanted to get the message across herself. She would have been the leader, the one releasing balloons. Some of the focus of the event would be on domestic violence, with Mary saying that the girls really loved their dad and that Jessica had wanted him to be a part of their lives, which is why she allowed him to come over that afternoon for a visit. She stated, "My sister wanted them to have a healthy relationship with their dad." She also said she believed that Aaron had killed the girls to get back at Jessica. He was angry and sad, and he wanted everybody else to feel the same way that he did, she said. The home where the girls were killed stood as a morbid reminder of the horrors that unfolded behind that front door. Jessica had moved out and moved in with her family right away, and the house would be put on the market. However, the listing was cancelled after Jessica contacted the agency to express the fear that Aaron would stand to make money on the sale of the house. His mother had contacted the agency on his behalf, and they weren't aware that he would be the one to receive the sale money. Following this, Affini Plus Federal Credit Union filed a lawsuit seeking foreclosure of the home. They accused Aaron of owing them around $172,000 and accused him of failing to make payments. Aaron had taken a 30-year mortgage out on the home, and he had agreed to make monthly payments of $800. He made the first payment, but since then he had not made any more. So in short, Jessica had been paying him rent, but then he was not using that rent to pay the mortgage. A judge would issue an order for foreclosure and sale, stipulating that the sheriff's office could sell the home since Aaron could not pay the remainder of his mortgage. A pretrial hearing was held towards the end of November, and for the first time, prosecutors revealed what they believed was the motivation behind the senseless murders. They said that Aaron had killed Amara, Sophie, and Cecilia in order to hurt Jessica. During the hearing, Aaron and his defense team were informed by the judge that they had until the 14th of December to file a motion to plead not guilty by reason of insanity, and until the 28th of December to request that the trial be moved elsewhere. The 14th of December would come and go with no new developments on the plea. Prosecutors had learned that the defense had hired 3 mental health experts, so it certainly appeared as though they were planning an insanity defense. Defense Kuczynski would appear in court where he would say that he had not yet received all of the evidence needed to make the determination on whether they would be entering a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity. By January, the decision still hadn't been made, so Judge Howard Cameron went ahead and made the decision to appoint mental health experts to examine Aaron on behalf of the prosecution. It was known that the defense had already hired their own experts, but now the prosecution had their own as well. Just the day after the ruling, however, Aaron appeared in court and entered a plea of not guilty by reason of mental disease and defect. Defense Kuczynski said that he had felt pressured by the judge and the prosecution to enter the plea. He went on to speak about the motivation the prosecution had put forward, that Aaron had killed the girls to get back at Jessica, telling the judge he loved the kids and he never did anything for revenge. And he loved Jessica. The farthest thing from his mind was actually harming her. The not guilty by reason of insanity plea meant that if Aaron were convicted of the charges, it would then need to be determined whether his mental state at the time of the murders made him responsible for the murders. If his defense team were successful in meeting the burden of proof, then he would be sent to a mental health facility as opposed to prison. The judge would accept the insanity plea, but deny a change of venue for the trial, meaning that the trial would be proceeding and it was scheduled to begin in April of 2013. He also ordered Aaron to undergo 2 separate psychiatric examinations before the trial began. It had become apparent by this point that the crux of the case wasn't whether Aaron had committed the murders or not. Both the defence and the prosecution agreed that he had been the one to kill his children. The result really depended on whether the jury believed he was legally insane at the time of the murders. However, as the trial was fast approaching, Aaron appeared in court once again where he changed his plea. He entered a plea of guilty but insane. The courtroom was filled with the girl's loved ones. Jessica gently cried as her former husband delivered the words she had been waiting for. Guilty. 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 The plea sent the trial on to the second phase, which would address his mental state at the time of the murders. The burden of proof was on the defence, and they were going to try and convince the jury that Aaron was not responsible for the murders because of a mental illness. Defence Kaczynski would state after the plea change, he believes that he has a mental illness, and he would like to end up in a mental health institute, so he can understand how this could have ever happened to him and his three girls. By the 31st of March, a jury consisting of 9 women and 5 men were seated, and the trial was ready to begin. During opening statements, Defence Kaczynski laid the groundwork for the insanity defence. He said that Aaron had become increasingly erratic and obsessive after he and Jessica divorced. He had been calling Jessica incessantly, and during these phone calls, he sometimes threatened to harm Jessica or the girls.
Victims of a horrible crime and a tragedy lost their lives before their lives basically got started. So a very tragic act. I have to prove to you to a reasonable certainty by the greater weight of the credible evidence that he had the mental illness and he lacked substantial ability to conform his conduct to requirements of law. And when he's with Cecilia, something happens. He doesn't recall what happens, doesn't know why it happened. All he recalls is he's choking the little one, Cecilia. Next thing he recalls, there's a lot of blood. Girls' throats are cut. He describes it as if it's in a kind of a dream. So he sees things happening. He sees himself pouring gas. In his mind, he's thinking of suicide.
Prosecutor Gary Freyberg would rebut this assertion, stating that their evidence would show that Aaron was not out of touch with reality and that he was not legally insane, telling the jury, "He's just mean to a degree that is almost inconceivable to the rest of us." He said that the murders were committed out of jealousy, anger, bitterness, and revenge, stating, "The truth of this case is that man knew exactly what he was doing, before, during, and after."
The evidence will show you that these crimes were premeditated. Premeditation simply means thinking about it in advance. He thought about it in advance. He thought about murdering his daughters for months before he finally did it. He talked with family and co-workers about what he was going to do. He fantasized about it for months. The evidence will show that he is not legally insane. He's just mean to a degree that's almost inconceivable for the rest of us.
He went on to detail all of the threats made against Jessica and the girls, and the threats made against Jessica's new boyfriend at the time. He said, "He was an angry man. His thoughts were of revenge." He then detailed the gruesome scene inside the home, revealing that after Aaron had slashed his daughter's throats, he had tied shirts around their necks to prevent their blood from pouring onto his clothing as he carried them to their respective beds. He then had a shower, changed clothing, and tried to blow up the house. These were the actions of a methodical man, the prosecution contended. One of the first witnesses to be called to testify was Jessica. She provided the jury with a poignant glimpse of a grief that thankfully very few of us will ever experience in our lifetime. She was shown a photograph of her three girls, and she immediately broke down before quietly saying, "My girls." She detailed the downfall of her relationship with Aaron, revealing that the straw that broke the camel's back was when she discovered that Aaron had dropped out of school, but lied to her. She acknowledged that Aaron appeared to be depressed, and had been depressed on and off since their relationship began in 1999, before worsening in 2007. She then went on to detail all of the threats that Aaron had previously made. She said that despite these threats, she never believed he would harm the girls. She did admit that she was worried about leaving the girls alone in Aaron's care, but she had worried that he would forget to feed them or put them to bed on time. Never that he would physically hurt them. When Jessica first spoke to police, she described Aaron as psychotic, truly irrational, crazy. But she testified that she didn't mean these words as in a mental diagnosis, but instead in a slang way. She said that Aaron had completely deceived her, telling the courtroom everything he'd done for the last part of June, up until that point, made me think that he loved them and that he wanted to see them. In the lead-up to the murders, Aaron had appeared to be getting better, and he made sure to let Jessica know this. She felt as though he had done this simply as a way to get close to the girls. Through much of Jessica's testimony, she held onto a necklace she was wearing that bore the names of her three girls. Her testimony was followed by other witnesses who had heard similar threats come from Aaron. Jared Klein, who worked with Aaron for the first half of 2012, testified that he was drinking heavily and was noticeably angry. He would make sporadic outbursts in regards to the divorce several times a week, and even spoke about offing his family, as well as the man that Jessica had been dating. Another co-worker, Jeremy Michaels, testified much to the same, telling the courtroom that he had heard Aaron talking about killing his family and the man Jessica was dating. On one occasion, Aaron had even told Jeremy that he would pay him to kill Jessica. Liz, Aaron's cousin, also testified, and so did his co-worker and roommate, John Paul, who said that he had heard Aaron talking about killing Jessica and the girls on several occasions. The trial would then focus on Aaron's depression. He visited Dr. Paul McMillan in April of 2011 and was diagnosed with a moderately severe major depressive disorder and prescribed medication. When he didn't respond to the medication, he was prescribed citalopram, which made a slight improvement. When he saw the doctor again in November of 2011, he said that he was stressed about the separation and the dose was increased. Aaron then went to see a therapist, Gretchen Link, who told the courtroom that Aaron had told her he was concerned about his marriage and feeling depressed. She said she believed that Aaron was suffering from a low-grade, ongoing depression. After a couple of days of testimony, there was some drama in the courtroom when a friend and co-worker of Aaron, who was scheduled to testify, Joe Rolig, approached an officer who was monitoring the metal detector and said he needed to speak with Aaron's attorney. The officer noticed that Joe had two knives, and it was later found that he had a third in his truck. Joe confided in a nurse that he'd been sitting in the parking lot, thinking about hurting or killing either the prosecutor or people who had been testifying against Aaron. He was charged with threatening a witness at a trial. Back in the courtroom, Dr. Ralph Barker, a psychiatrist, testified that it was his belief that Aaron had major depressive disorder, but he was not insane when he killed his daughters. He said that Aaron told him that the murders were a spur-of-the-moment thing. Aaron said to Dr. Barker that he went into the house, went upstairs to look at the girls' toys, and then gave them their piggy banks. He said he planned on taking them to the river, and as he was helping Cecilia try to find her shoes, the next thing he knew, he had her hands around her neck and was strangling her. Aaron told Dr. Barker he believed that Cecilia was dead, and as he went into the kitchen, he heard Cecilia crying. He said he grabbed a knife as Amara and Sophie went into their sister's bedroom to see what was wrong with her. He proceeded up the stairs and then slashed the throats of the three girls. He added that he was shocked by the amount of blood on them and on the bedroom floor. Dr. Barker told the courtroom that Aaron was aware of what he was doing because he could recall the murders in detail, including trying to set the house on fire, having a shower, calling Jessica, and then disposing of the evidence. Testimony would be presented in regards to Aaron's behaviour on the day of the murders, with two servers at a St. Paul tavern, a hotel official, and a rental car agent, telling the jury that he appeared to be normal. He had ordered two Bloody Marys and a beer on the morning of the murders. There would also be testimony about Aaron's actions after the murders, including washing clothes at the home, changing clothing, cleaning the murder weapon and putting it back. It was clear he was trying to conceal evidence. As the prosecution said, this was a clear indication that he knew wrong from right. The defence would then call on Aaron's parents to testify about his upbringing. His father, Roger, said that he was a rebellious and belligerent teenager who had run-ins with the law. He said that as a teenager he had stolen a gun and then brought it to school, where he was subsequently expelled. He had been sent to juvenile detention facilities twice for burglaries. Roger and Aaron's mother, Sue, said that he had been experiencing depression since childhood. Roger revealed that one morning his son had called him up and told him he wanted to hurt the girls to show Jessica how much pain he was in. The defence would then call on Dr. Reed Melroy, a psychiatrist they had hired. He believed that Aaron was suffering from catathymic homicide, which is a disorder that triggers disproportionate rage towards a spouse or intimate partner who has, or is planning to, leave the relationship. He said he believed that Aaron had a personality disorder that involved a dependence on Jessica, and that he tried to sever this dependence when he killed the girls. It was his belief that Aaron met the requirements of legal insanity. Following all of the testimony, closing arguments were presented. Once again, Prosecutor Freyberg said that the murders were motivated by nothing more than revenge and jealousy. He said that Aaron had chosen the satisfaction of revenge over the satisfaction of being a father. He spoke about catathymia, saying that it had some applications in psychology but did not apply to the legal definition of insanity. Defense Kaczynski finalized by telling the jury that in some ways that the murders were not really about people, but instead about dependency. He said, "This crime is deeply rooted in Aaron's dependency. That's where all this comes from." It would now be up to the jury to determine Aaron's fate. Did they believe the evidence of the prosecution or the evidence of the defence? Did they believe that Aaron was legally insane at the time of the murders? After deliberating for just 3.5 hours, they returned with a verdict. They rejected the insanity defence and concluded that while Aaron may have been mentally ill, he was legally sane at the time of the murders. As the verdict was read aloud, a sigh of relief emanated in the courtroom. Outside of court, Flint Watt, Jessica's uncle, said, "Aaron's going to be spending a long time, I think, thinking about what he's done, primarily to the girls and Jessica, but also, basically to himself, to his family, to the rest of our family." The sentencing phase would be held in July and victim impact statements were read aloud. Mary, Jessica's aunt, said that Aaron did not deserve his daughters.
"Every child is afraid of the dark, the boogeyman or the monster under the bed at some point in their lives. As parents, we protect them, love them, show them that the dark is not bad. The boogeyman does not exist and there are no monsters under the bed. Amara, Sophie, and Sia learned there is a boogeyman and the monster under the bed hides in even more sinister places. Aaron became the darkness, the boogeyman, and the monster under the bed. He was so evil that he took their unconditional love for him and used their love to lure them close enough so he could kill them. Aaron did this with the promise of love to only take their lives in such a manner that their last memories are the realization that their dad never loved them or cared for them. It was just a false illusion to cover up his evil darkness. I want Aaron to know they stopped loving him the moment that he harmed them in front of each other and then killed them. I don't think he was prepared for the fight the girls would give him or how he could no longer control everything. Their last memory is what an evil killer their dad was. Aaron should rot in hell of this world and eternity with his hatred, evilness, and cowardly ways. Let the darkness of his actions haunt him forever. Aaron is not mentally ill, just an extremely evil coward."
Her 15-year-old daughter, Erin, said that her three younger cousins could have made the world a better place, adding that what Aaron had done made no sense and most likely never would. She said, "I thought the world was a better place than this. People said there is sunshine on the other side of things that are like this, but so far, I don't believe them. Because there's always going to be that black spot that was created by evil." It was too difficult for Jessica to make a statement. Aaron's aunt, Patty Fix, asked Judge Cameron to consider Aaron's mental illness.
"But in talking about Aaron being a coward, I will promise you he's not a coward. He deserves, wherever you send him, he deserves to go for life. I will say that. Send him for life. But stop saying he's a coward. He's not a coward. He does have a mental illness. I know he has a mental illness. He owes a lot of people an apology, and I want him to have the opportunity to know what he's done to family and to community and the ripple effect this has had throughout families and I want him to understand it. I don't want him to just be thrown in a pit so that it's like, well, screw you. You killed our amazing girls. Now burn in hell or whatever these hateful, hateful things. And Mr. and Mrs. Schaffhausen have lost not only three amazing girls, they've lost Aaron."
She said that the warning signs were there, but nobody had helped Aaron. This was something that his father, Roger, also touched on.
"But I also believe that to some degree we're all responsible, and that if we all went a little bit further in reaching out to Aaron, maybe, just maybe, this could have been averted."
Judge Cameron handed Aaron Schaffhausen three life sentences without the possibility of parole. In announcing it, he said he did not see mental illness as a mitigating factor, instead referring to the murders as a vicious and aggravated crime. With Aaron behind bars for life, Jessica tries not to think about him. Instead, she thinks of her spunky daughters and what they would have become in life. She has since remarried and has a little boy and a little girl, Flint and Trinity Hope. Speaking of Amara, Sophie and Cecilia, she said to Lodi New Sentinel, "They made me who I am. Even the short amount of time I had with them has made life worth living." Aaron Schaffhausen had taken advantage of the love that his daughters had for him so that he could get close to them unattended. For weeks, he had been luring Jessica into a false sense of security, knowing that she would never put her own feelings for him before the love their daughters had for their father. In the end, the girls came to discover that the boogeyman who they feared wasn't somebody hiding underneath their beds, or a stranger in the night. It was their own father, the man who had used them as nothing more than a pawn to hurt his ex-wife. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. And a big massive thank you to my amazing new Patreon supporter, Brandy. You can join Patreon for as little as $1 a month, and there are absolutely no obligations. You can cancel any time. In return for your support, I upload ad-free and early release episodes, bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus that aren't on the regular podcast platforms, bonus content, which includes audio, videos, and case files, and I also send out a handwritten thank you card and some merch. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
T Tapes from the Dark Side.
Tapes from the Dark Side.
Tapes from the Dark Side
is an awesome new true crime podcast.
What motive could a father have for hurting his own son? What dark secret is Mark Redwine hiding? In season one, the host TZ Borden investigates the curious case of a missing 13-year-old boy and the father suspected of murder. Please go search Tapes from the Dark Side on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Tapes from the Dark Side.
You should give it a good listen.